Hello, I'm Michaela Maguire, Artistic Director of Sydney Writers' Festival. You're listening to a podcast recorded live at the 2019 Festival.
Hello everyone. Welcome to the Sydney Writers' Festival at Carriage Works. My name's Nadia Bailey and I'm a writer and critic from Melbourne, and I'll be facilitating this session with the wonderful Daisy Johnson. Thank you all so much for coming. I would like to acknowledge that we are gathered on stolen land and that Australia is built on the invasion and colonisation of sovereign nations. I acknowledge the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation and pay my respect to elders past, present and emerging. Now, before I introduce today's guest, just some quick housekeeping. If you haven't already done so, please turn your mobile phone to silent, but feel free to tweet or Instagram discreetly using the hashtag Sydney Writers Festival. There'll be a Q&A at the end of this session, so do have some questions in mind. And Daisy's books are for sale outside in the festival bookshop. There'll be a signing afterwards, so do pick up Everything Under and also her short story collection, Fen. It's now my great pleasure to introduce Daisy. Daisy is a writer of poetry, short stories and fiction. Her debut short story collection, Fen, was published in 2016, and her novel, Everything Under, came out last year. It was hailed as a force of nature in the New York Times Book Review and an entrancing debut in The New Yorker. Everything Under was shortlisted for the Man Booker Prize, making Daisy, at 27, the youngest ever author to earn that accolade, and it's also just been nominated for the Shirley Jackson Award. Please make Daisy very welcome. So, after reading this book, I basically went around recommending it to all my friends, but it soon dawned on me that it was actually quite difficult to kind of explain what it was about. And I settled on, it's a very exploded version of a Greek myth set in Britain on a river. How do you tend to describe it?
Yeah, I've had that issue trying to describe it in events. People often ask me and I completely hash it up and I think then nobody buys it, which is a bit upsetting. I think, yeah, it's a retelling. It's about family. It's about memories. It's about language. It's a dark book, I think, and it's not chronological. Yeah, it is. I like the phrase exploded. I think I've used that before. It's fragmented. I think it kind of, someone once described it, which I really liked, as it slightly mirrors the way I think memories come to us and thoughts come to us. It's not linear.
So just to sketch out a little bit of the plot for those of you who haven't read it, Everything Under tells the story of Sarah, a very singular, charismatic woman, and her daughter Gretel, who live in a houseboat on the banks of the River Cherwell in England. When Gretel is a teenager, Sarah vanishes, leaving Gretel to foster care, fluent in the invented language that the two of them share, but kind of hopelessly unable to deal with the outside world. As an adult, Gretel lives a solitary life, haunted by the memory of a brief period before her mother's disappearance, when a teenage runaway named Marcus joined their small family, who's connected to them both in a way that they don't realise. Daisy, would you like to read us a section of the book?
That was a very good description.
Oh, thank you.
So I'm going to read from the beginning. Thank you for coming. I know Alexander Chee is also on, so if anybody wants to go, then. Okay. The places we are born come back. They disguise themselves as migraines, stomach aches, insomnia. They are the way we sometimes wake falling, fumbling for the bedside lamp, certain everything we've built has gone in the night. We become strangers to the places we are born. They would not recognize us, but we will always recognize them. They are marrow to us. They are bred into us. If we were turned inside out, there'd be maps cut into the wrong side of our skin, just so we could find our way back. Except cut wrong side into my skin are not canals and train tracks and a boat, but always you. It is hard even now to know where to start. For you, memory is not a line, but a series of baffling circles, drawing in and then receding. At times, I come close to violence. If you were the woman you were 16 years ago, I think I could do it, beat the truth clean out of you. Now it is not possible. you were too old to beat anything out of. The memories flash like broken wine glasses in the dark and then are gone. There is a degeneration at work. You forget where you have left your shoes when they're on your feet. You look at me 5 or 6 times a day and ask who I am or tell me to get out, get out. You want to know how you got here, in my house. I tell you over and over. You forget your name or where the bathroom is. I start keeping clean underwear in the kitchen drawer with the cutlery. When I open the fridge, my laptop is in there, the phone, the television remote. You shout for me in the middle of the night, and when I come running, you ask what I'm doing there. You are not Gretel, you say. My daughter Gretel was wild and beautiful. You are not her. Some mornings, you know exactly who we both are. You get out as many kitchen implements as you can fit on the counter and cook great breakfast feasts, 4 cloves of garlic in everything, as much cheese as possible. You order me around my kitchen, my own kitchen, tell me to do the washing up or clean the windows for God's sake. The decay comes on these days slowly. You forget a pan on the stove and burn the pancakes. The sink overflows onto the floor. A word becomes trapped in your mouth and you hack at it, trying and failing to spit it out. I run the bath for you and we go hand in hand up the stairs. These are small moments of peace, almost unbearable. If I really cared about you, I would put you in a home for your own good. Floral curtains, meals at the same time every day, others of your kind. Old people are a species all of their own. If I really still loved you, I would have left you where you were, not carted you here where the days are so short they're barely worth talking about, and where we endlessly excavate, exhume what should remain buried. Occasionally we find those old words sneaking back in, and we are undone by them. It's as if nothing has ever changed, as if time doesn't mean a jot. We have gone back, and I'm 13 years old, and you're my awful, wonderful, terrifying mother. We live on a boat on the river, and we have words that no one else does. We have a whole language all our own. You tell me that you can hear the water effing along. I answer that we are far from any river, but that I sometimes hear it too. You tell me you need me to leave, you need some sheesh time. I tell you that you're a harpy doodle and you grow enraged or laugh so hard you cry. One night I wake and you are screaming and screaming. I skid along the corridor, knock your door open, put on the light. You are sitting up in the narrow spare bed with the sheets pulled to your chin and your mouth open, weeping. What is it? What's wrong? You look at me. The Bonac is here, you say. And for a moment, because it is night and I'm only just awake, I feel a rise of sickening panic. I shake it away, open the wardrobe and show you the empty inside, help you out of bed so we can crouch together and look beneath, stand at the window and peer out into the black. There's nothing there. You have to sleep now. It's here, you say. The Bonac is here. Thank you.
We're going to come back to the Bonac later. But I wanted to talk about some of the formal qualities of this book because, as we've mentioned, it unfolds in this quite unusual way, out of sequence and with a very disorienting tendency to kind of switch perspectives and switch time periods as well. How did you arrive at this form?
So I have a difficult relationship with this book in that we fought, we wrestled, and this book came into being through this complete, you know, it attacked me and I attacked it. And I rewrote it maybe 7 times from scratch, entirely from scratch. And the first draft of this book, the 5th draft, is entirely unrecognizable from what the book now is. And I think part of that fight was in the attempt to find how the book needed to be told. Mm-hmm. And it really is a book about memory and how memory is refracted through certain things, through childhood, through trauma. And the character, the main character, Gretel, who met in that reading, is remembering things, but they're coming to her at different times. Mm-hmm. She's having a very disorientating experience, feeling quite discombobulated. And I wanted the reader to also feel that way. I wanted you to feel the same as the characters. Mm-hmm. And that's why it isn't linear. And it isn't chronological. And I know that some people find it very disorientating and don't enjoy, I think as a writer, you have to lead the character, you have to lead the reader, you have to decide how much you're going to look after a reader. And at times, I think this book doesn't look after its reader.
In a good way, though. I think it's a book that the first reading is quite disorientating, but when you get to the end of it, you immediately kind of want to go back and read it again, because once you know what the story is, you almost have a completely different experience reading it the second time.
Yeah, and I saw George Saunders, for anyone else who saw him this week, and he said this amazing thing, which was something like, a book teaches its reader how to read it. And I think that's a really wonderful way to describe the experience of reading, because I think a book does tell you how you should experience and how you read it. And I think that's what I'm trying to do with this book. I'm trying to teach you how to look at the world and the events you're reading in a different way.
Mm-hmm. So you said you did 7 drafts of it?
I mean, 7 rewrites, yes. More than 7 drafts.
Yeah, right. So how long was that process?
I think it was around 3 years, but I was working on other things, 3 to 4 years. I was working on my first collection. I was working, I had a job, a few jobs. But yeah, about 3 years.
Mm-hmm. And were you fighting it the whole time, or was there a point where it suddenly kind of clicked into place for you?
There were moments of light, you know, like...
That's good.
yeah, I think for anyone who's a writer will know that kind of beautiful moment where you feel good. Mm. You know, you feel good about a project for the first time in months and months. There were also moments of sitting in coffee shops in Oxford weeping because I didn't know I had to write a novel. My publisher had said, we love your short story collection, we love short stories, now you have to write a proper book. So I knew that this is what I had to do. And then towards the end, particularly in the finding of the Gretel character and the realization that she was a lexicographer, there was a click. Mm-hmm. And the realization that it had to be set on the river around Oxford, there was a kind of click in my head. Mm-hmm. Everything began to fall into place, and it looked like a book rather than like a disparate, you know, pile of words.
Sure. So underpinning this book is a particular story from Greek mythology, and Daisy and I had a discussion where we were like, do we want to say which story it is? But then we realized it actually says in the program which story it is, so I think we're going to just go for it. And that story is Oedipus Tyrannus, or Oedipus Rex, the Oedipus myth. But it's also got all of these other elements, the river, this preoccupation with language, the idea of fear being kind of personified into a form of its own. So how did this story kind of come together for you, and how did you put these elements together?
Yeah, I was fascinated with the idea of retelling. I think probably firstly from Roald Dahl's Fairy Tales, in which he retells the fairy tales, and Cinderella flashes her knickers, and Little Red Riding Hood has a pistol stuck down her pants. And I thought these were, I think I remember reading them as a child and thinking, how can he do that? How can he take a story which, you know, we put on a pinnacle, I think. These ancient stories are quite sacred to us. How can he destroy it and rebuild it in a different way? And it seemed quite naughty, I think. And then later, older, I was reading a lot of retellings in which, the house of the story was entirely destroyed, and the house that was rebuilt was often feminist.
Yes.
Or exploring ideas about race, ideas about characters who are often silenced in some of those ancient stories. So I knew I wanted to retell, and what I really, really love about the Oedipus story is, A, that it's very, very dark, and it felt very much a story of its time. You know, it's a story about fate. It opens with a child being left in the mountain for the wolves, and it felt like a challenge. Could I set this in a contemporary time? I also love that it very much feels like a story which is rolling down a hill. There's a sense of inevitability coming both towards the characters, and I think you as the listener, as the reader, feel this awful sense of something moving very fast towards you. I was really excited about that. But I think a lot of the process was giving up the myth and realizing that I could do whatever I wanted with it, that I did need to destroy it. And certainly some of the ideas that have come out, ideas about language, ideas about motherhood, are not things from the myth. They're things that I think are buried in me and that I'm interested in bringing out.
Mm-hmm. And did you come to Greek mythology as a child or later in life?
Yeah, we had an audiobook of the Tales of Troy, I think, and which I listened to over and over and over again. I think mostly for the monsters. I really loved the monsters hidden in them. And this enormous darkness under the surface of these stories I was really intrigued by.
Mm. It's interesting that, you know, Greek mythology seems to be having kind of a moment in our society at the moment, like these retellings of Greek myths from, you know, Camilla Shamsie's Home Fires to Circe and so forth. Why do you think that they are having this particular resonance right now?
Mm. Yeah, I've thought about it a lot, and I've been reading a lot of them and loving them. You know, Circe and Pat Barker's The Silence of the Girls, I think, are really phenomenal feminist takes on these. I think a lot of literature is trying to say something about the time we're living in, and I think these stories try and do it from an angle. They almost trick you into it. You know, you think, okay, so actually I'm in ancient Greece, in kind of a camp of war on the beach, and you eventually realize that someone like Pat Barker is very much telling us something about the time we live in, and about the issues that are surrounding us now, and I love that trickery. I think that's maybe why people are returning to these stories. I also think perhaps, and I don't know how long this is going to go on for, but there's a sense of moving through history and giving voice to a lot of the characters who are silenced, you know, especially in Circe, who is in a lot of Greek myth. I think she's the her Greek goddess who turns men into pigs is kind of her. She's known as that. But her story is enormous. And I think Madeline Miller has succeeded in giving her this voice that she didn't have before, which I think is really intriguing.
Absolutely. You mentioned this idea of fate before and this kind of inevitable kind of thing that's following them. And I think that's kind of a fascinating concept when you think about that dichotomy between fate and free will. And I'd love to hear you talk a little bit about fate and how it works in your book.
Yeah, so I don't believe in fate. Mm-hmm. I think many people now don't. So a lot of the challenge of the book was creating characters who did believe in it. Not only who believed in it, but believed in it with everything they had, you know, the characters who, if they were told they were going to do something, wouldn't doubt the person who was telling them and wouldn't doubt that these were the events that they were going to come towards. I think it's this sense of momentum which fate gives. I also think this is a book very much balanced on, I think everybody reads every book differently. I think everybody reads this book differently because there are things in the book which you have to decide whether you believe in them or not. There's a monster in the book, which we're going to talk about. There's also events in the book which we're told are fated. You as a reader have to decide where you sit on that line. I like that gray space, I think, of belief. Yeah.
I also kind of find it fascinating that subtle difference between fate and destiny. It feels like destiny is something that you're running towards and fate is something that is sneaking up behind you. And I feel like in this book, yes, fate is definitely sneaking up behind them. But perhaps now we can talk a little bit about your road to becoming a writer. How did it start for you?
I think I always wanted to be a writer. Certainly that's what my mother says. I am very illogical, very bad at lots of things, very bad at school at things like science and maths and history and geography and lots of things.
Everything but English and literature?
Yeah, basically. everything but English literature and drama and art. I was good at these things and found a freedom in those, I think. I think, like most writers, I was an enormous reader. I was an odd child, often alone in a corner with a book, despite having, you know, siblings. And I think I had a fascination with the way, you know, reading people like, at the time, actually reading people like Kerry Hume and Stephen King, and Roald Dahl, and thinking, how have they done that? How have they made me feel this way? Mm. How have they entirely consumed me? And not at that time, you know, writing, but not understanding whether I was writing poetry or fiction. I think, yeah, writing with a kind of childlike freedom. And my parents were incredibly, helpful. You know, when I said I want to go to university and study English literature and creative writing, they said, yeah, of course you should do that. I did that at Lancaster, a northern city in the UK, and then went to Oxford to do a master's in creative writing. Mm-hmm. And had kind of been working on enormous novels. I was like, I'm going to write a trilogy retelling Dante, and it's going to be like at least 150,000 words per book.
Ambitious.
Yeah, and obviously it didn't work very well. Mm-hmm. And then I got really into short stories, particularly short stories by women. People like Kelly Link and Karen Russell and Sarah Hall, Flannery O'Connor. I found very inspiring, so I started writing short stories about the place I grew up, which is East Anglia, the Fens, which is a very, very flat land in the UK, which used to be covered by water, but the water was all drained, and it's now farmland, but it's incredibly dark farmland. And I think the thing that categorizes it for me is you can stand in one place and you can see for miles and miles, and also you can see what's coming towards you, I think. And so I wrote a collection of short stories called Fen, which is about being a young woman growing up in a rural place, where you can't even get the bus somewhere, you know, and before you can drive, you're trapped there. And that book wonderfully found an agent and then eventually found a publisher. And I got a 2-book deal. And yeah, as I mentioned, the second book had to be a novel. Mm-hmm. And I'd written novels before, but I'd never succeeded at a novel. So there was this enormous fear. And I was also very aware that I could not be a short story collection and make any money. I could barely be a novelist and make any money, but I wouldn't be able to live even a little off my short stories. Mm-hmm. Which is a very sad thing, I think. So there was a pressure to write a novel, and this is where that came from.
Yes. I'm glad you mentioned the kind of landscape that you grew up in, because it's so evident from both of your books that landscape does play such a huge role. And it's almost its own distinct character. Can you talk about that landscape, how both the Fens where you grew up and then the river? I believe you live near a river, and that is kind of the river that is in everything under. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, so location for me is vital when I'm writing, and if the location is wrong, the book or story won't come. So Everything Under was, to begin with, set in Wales and then was set in the city of Oxford where I was living and am now living. And it wasn't right, it wasn't clicking, the characters weren't existing there. I think also it's a book with monsters in. The monsters didn't feel real in the city. Mm-hmm. I don't think you as a reader could believe that they were really there. And then my partner and I one day borrowed his parents' houseboat. My friend said, you don't really have houseboats here, is that true?
Occasionally.
You do? Okay, she was wrong. Yeah, okay. And we're driving around the river and the canals around Oxford. And Oxford's quite a prim, proper place. You know, it has enormous, very imposing, I guess quite masculine-looking buildings. But the river is wild, floods. There were dead sheep in the water. There were fallen trees. And it felt like somewhere anything could happen. And there were also these houseboat communities which entirely lived off their own rules. I guess almost like traveler communities, the way we have them in the United Kingdom, where if something happened, you very much imagined you wouldn't call the police because you have your own system, you have your own structure in place. And that's exactly what I needed. I needed somewhere where, A, you believed there was a water monster in the water, and B, you also believed that children could go missing, but they wouldn't ask for help from the outside world.
Sure.
Yeah.
Are there any writers of place that you find particularly instructive?
Evie Wilde, I guess, is one of yours, isn't she? Yeah. We have taken her from you, and now she lives in London.
So many of them.
Evie Wilde, Sarah Hall, writers where the place is, particularly Evie Wilde, I think, the place is threatening. You talked about the place being a character, and the place is not necessarily a kind character. You always feel like, similarly with the fate idea, you're talking about the landscape is coming up behind you quite fast.
Yes.
And you're often battling it down. I guess also writers like Margaret Atwood, where landscape has an ecological themes running through it. People like that I was reading a lot.
Mm-hmm. And we can't really talk about place without talking about the Bonac. So tell us a little bit about the Bonac. What is it and where did it spring from for you?
Yeah. So you encounter the Bonac in that opening passage I read, hiding under the bed, perhaps. So Gretel and her mother Sarah live on the river when Gretel's a child until she's about 16. And there is no one else around. They're very isolated. It's just the two of them. They have an incredibly close relationship. And one of the things they do is create their own language. which at the time Gretel thinks is amazing, thinks is beautiful that they have this thing. She later realizes when her mother abandons her and she goes out into the world that she has been isolated by this language. Mm. She'll go to school and children will hear her using words they don't know and they'll laugh at her. She has been alienated by it. One of the words they come up with is bonak, which means the thing we are afraid of. So at different times throughout the book, it is a storm that comes or a rabid dog. Later, it becomes very clear that the bonak is a specific thing. It is a creature in the water, which is both a natural creature in the water, if that is what you want to believe as a reader. It is also, it's a book about something moving towards you, a truth moving towards you very fast. And the bonak is coming down to the river towards them the way that the truth is.
Yeah, it's both a personification and a literal monster in a way.
Yeah.
So one thing that struck me reading this book is that it's kind of partly written in direct address, although it's kind of not strictly second person, but Gretel always refers to Sarah, her mother, as you. Why did this feel like the right address to use?
Yeah, it was only in very late drafts that that came about. And I think it's a book about a mother-daughter relationship is a massive thing in the book. For Gretel, her mother is, you know, her son. Like, everything revolves. Even after her mother abandons her, everything revolves around this woman. She is entirely who she is because of how Sarah has brought her up. She's a lexicographer, works for a dictionary because of this language that she's been taught. You know, she's very isolated because that was how Sarah was. She has issues with sex because of the things Sarah has taught her or told her or done around her. So it had to be... Gretel, in a way, tells the story. You know, other characters emerge, but she takes on their voices. And I think for her as the character she is, who is, I think, quite shy, quite retiring, the only way she was going to tell the story was to her mother, both as a sort of accusation, you know, how could you do this to me when I was a child, and also as a way to remember, to return, and in returning, bring the memories back up. And I read a lot of really, I can't remember the author now, but there's an amazing book called Dear Thief, which is based on the Leonard Cohen song, is it Blue Raincoat?
Blue Raincoat.
Yeah. And is, yeah, in the form of a letter from a woman whose very close friend has an affair with her husband. And is a very angry book, you know, Dear Thief. And I was really interested in the amount of emotion behind something like a letter. Yeah.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you about the character of Sarah because she's kind of so vividly drawn and quite unlike anything I've encountered before. Where did she come from for you? And how did you kind of go about rounding that character into a fully fledged person? Because so much of the plot kind of hinges on her.
Yeah, I love her. And have very thankfully heard that readers love her as well because she is a very complicated, difficult character, a monster in some ways, I think. You know, the things she does knowingly or unknowingly throughout the book. I guess originally she came from the myth, from Jocasta. Mm-hmm. And then grew into her own character. I kind of think of her a little as the head of a cult. She has that sort of, I think, charisma that draws the light to her. She would walk into a room and you would look at her, I think, even if she wasn't doing anything. I wanted to write an unlikable woman. And God, she's like hideously unlikable, I think. and I wanted to write, this is something I did in Fen as well, I wanted to write a monster woman. In Fen, there's one story about women eating all the men in a little town in England. And I'm really interested in women who are hungry, not necessarily skinny, nasty women, and also women who are not naturally good mothers. Mm-hmm. We have a kind of sickening and strange, you know, relationship with mothers in our society, with women who are mothers, with women who can't be mothers, with women who don't want to be mothers, and also with women who aren't naturally maternal. which I think is one of the worst things you could possibly be as a woman. And Sarah is not naturally maternal. She never wanted children, but she has children, and she doesn't find it very easy to have them. And that was something I really, really wanted to explore, what happens if you have children, but it's not something that comes naturally to you.
So there's a particular sex scene in the book that I wanted to talk to you about.
And ever asked me about this before. Excellent.
If you've read the book, you know which scene I'm referring to. And sex scenes are notoriously difficult to write under the best of circumstances. And this one is, I would say, probably more difficult than most. But it does somehow manage to transcend that and almost be beautiful. How did you go about writing that scene? And what was the effect that you were aiming for?
It's a really good question. I really like writing sex scenes.
I'm glad to hear that.
For various reasons. I think I hate books where, you know, a couple are in a bar and then they go home together and then there's kind of like a weird paragraph break and then they're lying in bed and they're smoking a cigarette and they've clearly just had sex. And that's not how it works. Like, you don't black out, like, thankfully.
Ideally.
I want to see what's happening. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, for a lot of people, it's a vital part of what it means to be human and to interact with other people. And it also tells us a lot about characters. But we have something in the UK called the Bad Sex Awards.
Oh, yes.
And I'm torn about how I feel about this because, the last Bad Sex Awards was entirely men. And the way they wrote about vaginas and boobs was just, like, so horrific. You know, have you never seen a boob?
Possibly not.
Yeah, maybe not. Maybe they haven't. And we have a fear, you know, and that's the other way I feel about the Bad Sex Awards. It's like we shouldn't be telling people off for writing about sex because it is a really difficult thing to write about. Mm-hmm. And the sex scene in the book is a very difficult sex scene. And I wrote it from multiple points of views, from multiple characters to try and get it right and to try and think how it's happening. And I think also, I don't want to give too much away, but I think something happens in the scene. It's not just a sex scene. I think Sarah and perhaps even Marcus realizes something, which they hadn't realized and wouldn't have realized if they hadn't had sex. But I hope it's a successful sex scene. You know, I think it's not supposed to be disgusting, but it is supposed to be. You know, I think he like hits his head at one point and they're kind of all elbows and like some clothes get stuck. It's supposed to feel like a realistic sex scene, you know, and particularly the first time you have sex with someone, it's not beautiful. You know, it's not like immediately fireworks, like light bursting from you. It is awkward and fumbling, and I really wanted to try and show that.
Yes, I think it kind of really encapsulates that idea of fate. Like, you can see this scene coming a long way off, and yet when you get to it, it's still very confronting. But at the same time, I felt that the way that it was written with such sensitivity and such grace. Like, it's not a sordid scene, which in the hands of another writer, it could have been. Was that something that was playing on your mind when you were writing it?
I don't think so. Mm-hmm. I knew that I wanted it to be there. I didn't want it to be an absence. And there are other sex scenes in the book which are an absence. Gretel, I don't think ever does have sex, or she said we certainly don't observe her doing so in the book. Mm-hmm. I wanted it to be seen, but I certainly, it's not a titillating scene, I don't think. Yes. I don't think there's anything wrong with titillating sex scenes. I think they have their own place, but that's not what this is supposed to be. You know, for one thing, it's a scene between a very young boy, too young perhaps, a very young girl, and an older woman. Mm-hmm. And you are supposed to think, I think, as it's happening, should this be happening?
Yes, very much so. I'm quite fascinated that you were writing Fen and Everything Under concurrently. Did you find that they were feeding into each other, or were they very separate for you?
Yeah, I think they have similar themes and things that I don't think I've worked through yet, particularly things about language and, you know, the kind of the aggression of language, the sometimes colonial aspects of language. I am a very bad speller. I think... probably just about dyslexic. So I have this complicated relationship with language where it's It's my job. It's now the thing that I'm making enough money to live off, but it doesn't always work for me. It doesn't always do what it's told. Mm. Sometimes people will say, you know, that your sentences are so interesting and different and original, and clearly I just can't use punctuation properly. And I think that's something that will always come up. I think also at the moment I am only able to write books set in the countryside with women as the protagonists.
Because they're all women in fairness. Yeah.
Yeah, they're all women. All women in this, at least the ones who we are given voice to. And I wonder if one day I will have worked through these things and I will write a book narrated by a man set in, like, London. But there are things that are going round and round and round in my head and I can't quite escape from them. At the same time, I read Fen now, and I could go through it with a red pen and change every other line. Mm. You know, I think I started that book when I was maybe 23, 22, which I'm not now. And I haven't got to that point with everything under yet. I'm still in the same place, I think. And you can't do that, you know. You can't hate your early work because it's a description of who you were at the time, and you wouldn't... Yeah, the week after you finish something, you would write it differently. Yeah.
So let's talk a little bit about the Man Booker, because obviously that's a pretty huge deal. So what was it like kind of finding out that you'd made that long list and then the short list?
Yeah. Yeah, it was the best thing that's ever happened. And my publisher doesn't tell me what prizes they put me up for. I think probably so I can't say, well, why is Ian McEwan up for the Man Booker and I'm not? So I was babysitting this little girl I used to look after, and my editor rang me, which she very rarely does, and she said, oh, can you go somewhere quiet? I thought someone had died. I thought she was leaving me. I thought she hated everything I'd ever written, and she just wanted to tell me. And then she said, you've been longest for the Man Booker. And so then this little girl and I went and ran around a playground and screamed for like an hour. I think it is the biggest thing that can happen. And to have it for my second book, to have it for a book that I thought no one was going to like. Those judges liked it. Oh, you might not like it.
They'll like it.
Just for those people to say, actually, and to be on a list with other people who were doing such innovative things, was enormous. It has freaked me out, I think. As I kind of come to the end of writing my next book, I am panicked. Because it is a different book from everything under, and you can't write the same book twice. We'll see what happens. But no, it was amazing. I'm not going to say it wasn't amazing. Mm. Yeah, yeah, we drank so much.
Yeah. And so how has that accolade kind of changed things for you, just in terms of like your life as a writer?
I am here.
Yes,
which I would never have been. I'm traveling a lot more. I think something happened when I published Fen. A lot of my friends at home suddenly thought I was minted. I had loads of money. You know, they'd be like, you can buy this round in the pub. And I'd be like, actually, I can't. I wasn't living off my writing. I was working three different jobs at, you know, in different times and different places. This has enabled me, at least for the moment, we'll see what happens, to live off my writing, which is an enormous thing. And, you know, is the dream that I always hoped that I would be able to do, that I would just be able to write. You know, I also teach. I also do things like this. Not all festivals pay you. The Sydney Writers Festival is astounding in, like, that they pay you. I won't talk about this very long, but some festivals in Britain don't pay you.
Yeah, right.
And there's a lot going on at the moment with Philip Pullman and people like that saying, actually, that is an atrocious thing to do. Mm. You know,
pay
it's your
writers.
Job. Yeah. Yeah. it's just given me, I think, also the freedom to write what I want next and to take a little bit more time over it. And the next book is a horror novel. I think it's maybe quite a short horror novel. Like, don't tell anyone that I told that, said that, because my editor hasn't decided yet. I think the freedom is enormous. I can't kind of say how big it's been. Mm-hmm. I think prizes like that are so, so important for writers.
Mm. Do you think you'll go back to short stories, or are you looking to novels as your primary focus right now?
I will always go back to short stories. Uh-huh. I think they are my... I began as a short story writer, as someone who studied Yeah, did you see Will Self saying that someone who'd done a creative writing course could never live off their writing?
Rude.
Yeah. yeah, like I, as someone on a creative writing course, I learned how to write by reading short stories and by writing short stories. I find novels very big and baggy, and you know, the weight of a novel in your brain is enormous, you know, is immense, carrying that around with you for, you know, 2 to 7 years. And a short story, there is something about its brevity which I find very releasing after writing novels. So it's something that I always go back to in between have done since the beginning.
Yes. Like, I've always felt that short stories are kind of closer to poems than novels.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Yeah, they're quite self-contained.
Yeah, and every word, you know, in a short story has to be entirely perfect. And,
What would you say the main challenge of writing short stories as opposed to writing a novel?
Tricky. I think the length with novels, it sounds a very obvious thing, but I find that very difficult. I'm a rewriter as a writer. I tend to write a draft of something and then delete it entirely. Not delete it, it's still there, but get rid of it and begin again. And to do that with a 5,000 word story is fine. To do that with 70,000 plus words, it is, you know, there's this feeling of elegy, I think, of enormous grief.
Yes.
I think short stories are very unforgiving. I think if a short story doesn't work, I think people are very impatient with short stories in a way that they're not with novels. I think novels get away with things that short stories just don't. I think you have to immediately hold the reader's attention in a short story in a way that I think people take a little bit longer with novels, give it more of a chance.
So returning to Everything Under for a minute, when you were writing it, did you have kind of a reader in mind, or were you writing it for yourself primarily?
I think I thought it wasn't going to work, so I don't think I was writing it for anybody else. Although I do have three friends who I send everything to who read all of my work.
Are they also writers?
Yeah, they are also writers. Sometimes even before my agent, which I think really pisses him off. So maybe I was writing it for them. Fen, I think I was writing for the teenage girl that I was, who was, angry and uncertain. This, I think I was just writing to see if I could do it. But there is that phrase, you know, kind of write the book you want to read. I think this is the book I would like to read. Mm-hmm. I think certainly this is the... I was reading fragmented books. Yeah, I think maybe in these strange times, we're kind of looking for different ways to talk about everything. And I think fragmentation is maybe one of those ways to explore the things that we aren't ready to talk about, you know. I wonder if straightforward novels... I love chronological novels, and I love horror, I love thrillers. I read a lot of crime and fantasy, but I think the fragmented novel, the reason there are so many around is because that is a new way in, a new way to talk about it. I've forgotten your question, but I'm just...
That's fine, so have I. So we are going to go to audience questions now. So if you do have a question for Daisy, please raise your hand.
Hi there, Daisy.
Hi.
Just had a question. I'm fascinated to know what came first for you, whether it was the myth or whether it was the story. Did you honestly begin by saying, I'm going to rewrite the Oedipus myth, or did you begin on the story and then notice the myth within the narrative?
Yeah, I began on the myth. The myth was really the seed, there were certain characters in the myth which I started writing with first. So the Tiresias character, who is now Fiona, is kind of the prophet character. Originally, I wrote a lot of a novel from her point of view. It was actually a hymn at the time of my writing. But the myth was the first thing. I knew that I wanted to do this kind of destruction. Yeah, thank you.
Daisy, I was really interested in the beginning. You talked about the tussle that you had with this novel, and 7 complete rewrites is quite extraordinary, I think. I'm wondering, if you hadn't have had the 2-book deal, was there ever a point where you felt to just put this one to the side and start with another one? And I want to know, if you didn't have the 2-book deal, would you perhaps have just left this one to the side? Or what was the thing that drove you to keep persisting with this one, given that you rewrote it seven times?
Yeah, terrifyingly, I think I would have put it aside and worked on something else. But I now feel a little like it should be a tussle. I think it should be a little bit of a wrestle. I don't know how much I believe this, but I think Michelangelo talks about sitting in front of a block of stone, right? Yeah, and staring at it until he knows exactly what's underneath. And I sometimes feel kind of, and I know Sarah Perry thinks the opposite of this, but I sometimes feel mystically that the book is there and that you're digging and digging and digging and you come across bits of it. But it is a fight, you know. I think you are kind of fighting it into existence. Certainly, I feel that way. I don't know if this is going to be a progression, but my next book is coming to me easier. I think I've learned things from Everything Under, which have gone into the writing of that, which is kind of beautiful. And I think then the book after probably will be just as difficult. But I think I would have put it aside. But I think there were also people who were saying, you know, who were talking to me about it. Like, I have a very good editor who I like. I had a different agent at the time, but I have an agent at the moment who, you know, is always there for me to be like, okay, so what did you think about time travel? And he's like, I don't think time travel belongs in this novel, actually. But, you know, I think it's a myth that a writer is the only person who writes a book. You know, there were a lot of... there were a lot of people involved in the writing of this book who I think would have told me to carry on, hopefully, maybe. Yeah.
I think that having deadlines is so important for a writer as well.
Yeah, yeah. And I do think you can overwork a book, overwork anything. And having a deadline is so good because at some point you have to send it off. You have to let it go. And I very much believe that once anything is finished, not even published, once you've given it to someone else, it doesn't belong to you anymore. You know, readers will say things about the book which I didn't think at the time. And I really like that because it's not my book anymore. It's, yeah, everyone else's book.
I've been told to stand up.
Hello.
I was wondering, and I feel very intimate. obviously with Fen and Everything Under and obviously your next book coming up, you're working in like a very horror space. And there's been a huge presence at this festival alone of women writers working in the horror genre, which I think is very of the moment in a cultural kind of zeitgeist that we're living in. And I wonder if you have any thoughts specifically about how women relate to horror, fear, monsters, and your relationship to that kind of dialogue.
Thank you. So I'm a Halloween baby. I was born on Halloween. So I kind of grew up... Shocker.
I literally gasped out loud. I was so excited. The coolest.
So I kind of grew up watching, you know, like Carrie and The Exorcist. And and I think you're right. I think there's been a lot. Yeah, particularly this festival. It's really noticeable and really exciting. And, you know, horror films the last 10 years have been doing really interesting things with... you know, films like Girl Walks Home Alone, It Follows, The Babadook, kind of exploring feminism or what it means to be a woman, all of Jordan Peele's films which explore race. I think in a similar way to what I was talking about how retelling looks at something from an angle, I think horror does that. It convinces us to think about something that we're, you know, without looking at it straight on. It's scaring you, but it's also talking about everything that's going on around us. Why is it now? I think these things are in the... I think conversations about, you know, Me Too and this world we live in are very relevant and very, very important. But there is an exhaustion with it, you know. There are days I can't read the news. I have to turn the radio on to a different station. And I think we maybe all have those days. But if we do it through the lens of something else, if we say... You know, and every monster in horror, every monster in all the books at this festival, you know, Sarah Perry's Melmoth is both a monster to frighten you, but there's also something stood on its shoulder or stood behind it that it's also showing you. You know, the monster in Everything Under is both an actual monster, but it's also representing a lot of things that are in the book. And I think that's a really exciting way to use monsters. I hope that answers your question.
Okay.
Good.
We got some other questions.
Hi.
Hi.
Sorry, hear your voice. So I actually wanted to ask about the characters and the characterization. Mm-hmm. So throughout the book, we get a lot of the characterization and personification through the memories of Gretel. I was actually wondering if it was different writing that sort of character of Gretel than it was to the characters in the memories like Marcus, mm-hmm. and how that differed.
Yeah, really different. I actually found the Marcus sections very difficult to write. I don't know why. But then on the other hand, I find first person quite challenging. You know, I think it's very easy to be entirely bored in first person and to feel, you know, I feel this, I feel this, I feel this, which I think you have to be really, really careful of as a writer. I felt a distance to Marcus, I think, as I was writing it, but those sections are the ones that people say they enjoy the most. You know, the sections where Marcus is walking along the river, which I think is really interesting. It is nice to enjoy writing as a reader, but just because you're not enjoying writing a section doesn't mean it's not working. I have my favorite characters in the book. I love Sarah. I really love the character Fiona. And I tried not to let that change the way I was working with them and change the way I related to them.
One thing I did want to talk to you about was just kind of like looking at, now that you've had a little bit of time away from it, looking back on it, what's the kind of dominant theme or idea for you, mm-hmm. if you had to kind of encapsulate it?
Whoa.
I know. Ending on a tricky one.
I think probably family, I think. Mm. And this is a personal story, and I don't know why I'm telling you, but my mother's father was a very difficult man, mm-hmm. You know, quite abusive to his wife, to my grandmother when they were younger, and my uncle decided he was never going to see him again. He was very young when the abuse was happening. And then at his funeral, my uncle sobbed. You know, no one was crying as much as him. And I think it really made me think about how much family get away with, mm-hmm. you know, things that no one else in your life will get away with, the people you're related to get away with. And you have to decide at some point in your life, I think, how much your love is unconditional. And I think that's a little bit what it's about. It's about living with people who are not... I have a very good relationship with my mother, but it's about living with people who aren't easy, but you're related to them. So how do you do that? You know, how do you kind of survive that, I think?
How do you survive your family?
Yeah, how do you survive your family?
Question for the ages. Now, Daisy's book is outside. In fact, both of Daisy's books are outside in the festival bookshop. I highly recommend picking up both of them. Daisy will be doing a book signing just outside as well. So please, if you do have questions that you were too shy to ask, Daisy will answer them then. And please join me in thanking Daisy Johnson.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, please remember to subscribe and rate our channel.